The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. Will zinc help control hirsutism in women? Question. I am a woman in my 20s, and I have a problem with facial hair. In researching this, I read an article suggesting zinc supplementation for controlling hirsutism in women. But I also found some articles that said zinc can be used by men to grow their beards. I found this confusing. What are your thoughts? The answer? Your question sent us to PubMed, to check the medical literature. We were fascinated to find a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of magnesium, zinc, calcium, and vitamin D supplementation, cited in the Biological Trace Element Research, March 2018. In this trial, 60 women with polycystic ovary syndrome, which frequently causes hirsutism, took placebo or a combination of 100 milligrams magnesium, 4 milligrams zinc, 400 milligrams calcium, and 200 international units or IUs of vitamin D for 3 months. At the end of the study, the women taking the supplements had significantly less facial hair and less inflammation. These doses are quite reasonable, so you might want to try this regimen to see if it helps you. Question. I've read that spices like cinnamon, cloves, rosemary, turmeric, and the like are anti-inflammatory and help to prevent dementia and control blood sugar and blood pressure. As I understood it, they should be taken in moderation, 1/4 teaspoon or less, with food, but frequently. What can you tell me about this? And the answer is, there is growing evidence that dementia is associated with brain inflammation, cited in Human Molecular Genetics, April 19, 2018. Spices like sage, rosemary, and lemon balm have been shown to improve memory, cited in Phytomedicine, January 15, 2018. There also is research supporting the use of ginger or turmeric to help control blood sugar, cited in Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine, January 9, 2018, and Pharmacological Research, February 2018. You can learn much more about these and other health benefits in our book, Spice Up Your Health. Did antihistamine increase risk of dementia? Question. Both my mother and mother-in-law were diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Mom was 76 and my mother-in-law was 72. They lived very different lifestyles. Mom dealt with severe anxiety and depression, while my mother-in-law was a happy-go-lucky, active and vivacious health nut. The only common denominator they shared is that they both took diphenhydramine, or Benadryl, to sleep. Their doctors advised this. Recently, an older friend at church said her doctor had advised her to do the same. I cautioned her against it. Of course, our mothers might have developed Alzheimer's regardless. I do believe diphenhydramine exacerbated the tendency. We must be our own health care advocates and watch out for our elderly loved ones as well. Answer, diphenhydramine or Benadryl is an old-fashioned antihistamine that was originally developed to treat allergies. Because it often makes people drowsy, drug companies have added diphenhydramine to over-the-counter sleeping pills. Virtually all, quote, PM, unquote, nighttime pain relievers contain this drug. Diphenhydramine is an anticholinergic medicine because it interferes with the action of the brain chemical acetylcholine. Long-term use of strong anticholinergic drugs have been linked to the risk of dementia. That's in BMJ, April 25, 2018, British Medical Journal. A review of sleep medicines in older adults concluded that diphenhydramine should be avoided in the elderly, cited in Clinical Therapeutics, November 2016. We have written extensively about the hazards of medications for older adults in our book, Top Screw-Ups. Question. My ophthalmologist recommended fish oil capsules, but I noticed no benefit from a 2,400 milligram daily dose. However, a second ophthalmologist said that my eyes would be the last organ to receive the oil. She suggested I try increasing the dose if I could tolerate it. I gradually went up to three 2,400 milligram capsules. I have now gone from using eye drops about 20 times a day to 5 or 6 times a day. As a retired statistician, I can assure you that is a statistically significant difference. Answer. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine, April 13, 2018, found that 3,000 milligrams of fish oil was no better than placebo for alleviating dry eye symptoms. That said, your experience sounds compelling. Many other readers also believe fish oil helps their dry eyes. One wrote, "Fish oil most definitely helps my dry eye problem. As soon as I started taking 2,000 milligrams a day, I could tell a difference. If I go off of it, my eyes are dry within a couple of days. The brand matters." Question. I use over-the-counter athlete's foot cream from the dollar store as an overnight remedy for cracks in the corners of my mouth. I finally figured this out for myself after many years of relying upon lip balm alone. Answer. You're describing angular chelitis, or chelitis, a.k.a. Perlesch, P-E-R-L-E-C-H-E. It is sometimes caused by moisture trapped in the corners of the mouth. This can lead to an overgrowth of fungus. That's why an antifungal cream for athlete's foot sometimes can help this condition. This painful and unsightly condition also can be caused by nutritional deficiencies. You should be checked to see whether you are getting enough B vitamins, iron, and zinc. From the Wall Street Journal, can DNA shed light on depression? Study shows gene tests can be effective in helping psychiatrists prescribe antidepressants. Paxil or Prozac, Zoloft or Lexapro. When treating a patient suffering from depression, Brent Forrester considers which antidepressant to prescribe, ideally one that will ease psychic pain without side effects. It can be a tough call. Deciding becomes somewhat of an art, and a lot of it is educated guesswork, says Dr. Forrester, chief of geriatric psychiatry at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, an affiliate of the Harvard Medical School. He worries that sometimes psychiatrists may think we are better than we really are at making these choices. That may change as Dr. Forrester and others enlist genomics, a form of precision medicine, and an intriguing new frontier for the elusive science of the human psyche. Other branches of medicine, such as oncology, have embraced gene-based testing to help determine which cancer patients need chemotherapy or surgery. But psychiatrists typically haven't used genomics to guide treatment decisions, Dr. Forrester says. One test, called GeneSight, uses a genetic analysis of DNA samples from a cheek swab to help doctors figure out which drugs are likely to combat a patient's depression. The test examines a dozen genes to determine how well the patient will metabolize certain drugs and how his or her brain will respond to them. The test predicts the effects of more than 50 antidepressants and antipsychotics. Based on a patient's results, drugs are categorized as ones to be avoided, ones that have some drawbacks, and ones that can be used as directed. Barbara Delavade, a retired real estate broker in Acton, Massachusetts, became depressed last year. Ms. Delavade, who is 78 years old, was taking an antidepressant, but I wasn't reacting well to it, and it wasn't helping me at all. She consulted Ipsit Vahia, a geriatric psychiatrist at McLean Hospital and assistant professor at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Vahia told Mrs. Delavade about the genomics test, which retails for $1,500 and is covered by Medicare and some health plans. After receiving an analysis of Ms. Delavay's results, he switched her to a different antidepressant, and she began to respond in about 6 weeks, he says. Ms. Delavay has been feeling better, she says, though I am still not there. Dr. Vahia has been using the gene test more with his older depressed patients, but says clinical judgment remains paramount in prescribing. McLean Hospital is one of 60 sites across the country that took part in a randomized trial of GeneSight, and that's spelled G-E-N-E-S-I-G-H-T. The results, unveiled recently at the American Psychiatric Association meeting, showed that patients fared better when physicians chose a medicine or medication with the help of the test, rather than relying solely on their judgment. Among the 1,167 patients in the trial, half took the GeneSight test and half were prescribed drugs based purely on their doctor's clinical assessments. Genetics helps you marry a patient with the appropriate medication, says Brian DeCaro, Executive Vice President for Clinical Development at Myriad Genetics, which funded the trial. AssureX Health, a subsidiary of Myriad Genetics, developed the GeneSight test. The results were striking, according to the doctors at several medical centers who participated in the trial. Patients were more likely to respond to antidepressants when the gene test was used to determine which drug they should be on. Researchers found a 30% greater response to the medicine when the gene test was applied. Every patient in the trial had been on at least one antidepressant that failed to work, and some had been on several that failed. The study shows that genetic tests can lead to better prescribing decisions, says John Greeden, the principal investigator in the trial. Dr. Greeden, a psychiatrist and executive director of the University of Michigan's Comprehensive Depression Center, says that until now, many doctors took the following approach. My favorite antidepressant is this one, so I will try it. Oh, that didn't work, so I'll try this one. Unfortunately, he says, under that hit-or-miss method, albeit informed by training and experience, fewer than 40% of patients achieve remission. Every year, 16 million Americans suffer an episode of depression. He says making pinpointed diagnoses essential. Some doctors took a while to come around to the GeneSight test. Charles DiBattista, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine, says initially he was somewhat skeptical. Prior to the study, I used it very rarely, says Dr. DiBattista, who specializes in patients with treatment-resistant depression. He has been using the test more on patients who have had problems tolerating medicine in the past. He says, there's nothing magical about it. It is not a substitute for clinical judgment, but it does inform him what drug to try on a patient with serious depression. His Stanford colleague, Alan Schatzberg, isn't persuaded. The test has some value, says Dr. Schatzberg, a psychiatrist and a former president of the American Psychiatric Association. It has some use, but what it doesn't do is tell you which specific drug to use, he says. What the field really wants is a test that tells me which specific drug I should put my patient on. That is precisely what Charles Conway, a professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, likes about it. The test provides recommendations, Dr. Conway says. It doesn't say give this drug only. It says you have a range of choices which you will make based on your clinical judgment. Now from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, tinnitus, a sound only you hear. Ringing in your ears. You may have experienced it from time to time or after a loud concert or mowing the lawn. But for some people, that perception of ringing is frequent or constant. This is known as tinnitus and is a symptom, not a disease. Tinnitus is the sensation of hearing a sound when no external sound is present. The sound can be described as a ringing, buzzing, roaring, clicking, humming, pulsing, hissing, or any combination of these sounds. You may hear it in one or both ears. The sound may be present all the time or off and on. If you have tinnitus that doesn't go away, a hearing evaluation is recommended. In most cases, tinnitus is fully manageable, but for some, it's a chronic condition that can affect sleep and everyday function. Fortunately, there are options to reduce its impact. What causes tinnitus? The cause of tinnitus is unknown. One idea is that tinnitus results from damage to the cells of the inner ear. This stems from the fact that about 90% of people with tinnitus have some hearing loss caused by noise. The tiny, delicate hairs in your inner ear move in relation to the pressure of sound waves. This movement triggers the release of an electrical signal through your auditory nerve to your brain. Your brain normally interprets these signals as sound. If the hairs inside your inner ear are damaged, bent, or broken, they may release random electrical impulses to your brain, resulting in tinnitus. In many people, tinnitus has been linked to hearing loss, both age and noise-related. It can occur from earwax blockage, from bone changes in the middle ear, otosclerosis, and as a side effect of a number of medications. Other conditions associated with tinnitus include head trauma or concussion, inner ear conditions such as Meniere's disease, or an acoustic neuroma, head or neck injuries, or problems with the joint where your lower jawbone meets your skull, which is temporomandibular joint. High blood pressure, as well as factors that increase blood pressure, such as stress, alcohol use, and caffeine consumption, can make tinnitus more noticeable. Management options. Although there's no known cure for most cases of tinnitus, many people are able to manage it. For most people, the goal is to lessen their awareness of tinnitus. Options that may help include treating an underlying condition. If tinnitus is due to a health condition, your doctor may be able to recommend steps that could reduce the noise. This may involve removing excess earwax, treating an underlying vascular condition, or changing medications if one is contributing to the problem. Hearing aids. Properly fitting hearing aids can address hearing loss, and tinnitus can sometimes be reduced if you can better hear sounds around you. Tinnitus maskers. In some cases, white noise may help suppress tinnitus so that it's less bothersome. Therapy. There are several promising therapy options for management of tinnitus. These include music therapy devices and methods for management of tinnitus. Tinnitus retraining therapy, or TRT, which involves using devices to train the brain to ignore tinnitus, and cognitive behavioral feedback, which focuses on replacing negative thoughts with positive ones in order to change your reaction to tinnitus. Repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS. Some evidence suggests that this non-invasive therapy using a magnetic coil to deliver electromagnetic pulses into brain tissue may reduce tinnitus symptoms in some people. This treatment is considered experimental and further research is required. And then finally, medications. There's not an approved drug to cure tinnitus, but in some cases, medications such as certain antidepressants may help reduce the severity of the symptoms. And seek support. A licensed therapist can help you develop coping techniques. Support groups also are available in person and online. Exercise and relaxation therapy may also help, as stress can make tinnitus worse. Covering the sounds of tinnitus. And I'm going to go through four devices and what they do. First is a hearing aid. If tinnitus resulted from hearing loss, a hearing aid may improve your hearing and reduce the perception of tinnitus. The next is white noise machine. This produces constant background or white noise or simulated environmental sounds such as falling rain or ocean waves. Fans, humidifiers, and air conditioners and the bedroom may also help cover the internal noise at night. Masking device. These devices, which resemble hearing aids or are sometimes combined with hearing aids, produce low-level sounds that reduce the perception of tinnitus. And finally, tinnitus retraining device. A wearable device delivers individually programmed tonal music to mask the specific frequencies of your tinnitus. Over time, this device may help you become accustomed to the tinnitus. The device is often combined with counseling. Second opinion. When can I stop getting pap smears? Whether you need to continue getting pap smears depends on your age, your risk factors for cervical cancer, and the results of your past pap tests. During a pap test, your doctor uses a brush to retrieve cell supplies or cell samples from your cervix to look for abnormal changes. Pap tests may also be combined with a human papillomavirus or HPV test, which looks for the presence of high-risk strains of the sexually transmitted virus HPV, the biggest risk factor for cervical cancer. In general, women older than 65 don't need pap testing if their previous tests were negative and they have had three pap tests or two combined pap and HPV tests in the preceding 10 years. However, there are situations in which your doctor may recommend continued pap testing. Women with a history of cervical cancer with high-grade abnormal pap tests in the past 20 years should continue cervical cancer screening. Other women at high risk who should continue screening past age 65 include those with a compromised immune system and those who were exposed before birth to DES, a drug given in the U.S. between 1940 and 1971 to prevent pregnancy complications. If you've had a complete hysterectomy, which means both the uterus and cervix have been removed, you don't need a pap test again unless you have had cervical cancer or DES exposure or high-grade abnormal pap test in the past 20 years. Most women don't need a pap test after a hysterectomy, especially if the hysterectomy was for a non-cancerous or benign condition such as fibroids or bleeding. If a vaginal pap test is needed, your doctor will collect a sample from the upper part of the vagina called the vaginal cuff. As always, it's best to consult with your doctor about your individual risks and recommendations for screening. The question, how long do I need to take beta blockers after a heart attack? Your doctor will likely consider a number of factors in making that decision. Guidelines recommend beta blocker therapy for 3 years, but that may not be necessary. Beta blockers work by blocking the effects of the hormone epinephrine, also called adrenaline. When you take beta blockers, your heart rate and blood pressure are reduced. This eases the workload on your heart and improves blood flow. At one point, beta blockers were used in the emergency department to limit heart muscle damage at the time of a heart attack. Current methods for treating a heart attack, which include clot-dissolving medications and surgical opening of blocked arteries, together referred to as reperfusion, improve blood flow without the risk of beta blockers. Immediate use of beta blockers, particularly intravenous high doses, can be harmful in people who have decreased blood flow to their organs or whose heart muscle is already weak and pumping ineffectively. Beta blocker therapy is recommended after emergency heart attack treatment to reduce your risk of irregular heart rhythms, chest pain, or another heart attack. In the past, many people have taken beta blockers for years, often indefinitely after a heart attack. Experts are questioning whether this long-term therapy is necessary in people who don't have heart failure, especially now that aspirin and cholesterol-lowering statin therapies have become reliable agents in managing heart disease. Recent evidence suggests that for most people with normally pumping hearts, beta blockers may only be beneficial in the first year or so after a heart attack. If you're still on a beta blocker several years after a heart attack and don't have heart failure, talk to your doctor about the pros and cons of maintaining your regimen. The Mayo Clinic Health Letter, atrial fibrillation. Basic steps to stop a stroke. thanks to quick thinking on the part of your spouse and expert care in the emergency department, you survived a stroke with only minor long-term effects. You were also diagnosed with atrial fibrillation and abnormal heart rhythm or arrhythmia, primarily affecting the upper two heart chambers, the atria. It's a problem you never knew you had, but your doctors suspect it may have contributed to the stroke. Not everyone with atrial fibrillation can feel symptoms such as heart palpitations or shortness of breath. Either way, atrial fibrillation can lead to blood clots in the heart. These heart clots can travel to and block arteries that supply blood to the brain. The blockage can result in the most common type of a stroke, which is an ischemic stroke, in which the brain doesn't receive enough blood flow. Having atrial fibrillation makes you 5 to 6 times more likely to have an ischemic stroke. If an older adult without atrial fibrillation had a 1 or 2% risk of ischemic stroke over the next 5 years, that would mean the risk of a stroke rises to 5 to 12% if atrial fibrillation is present. In addition, atrial fibrillation is more common among older adults, affecting about 2 to 5% of at around age 65 and about 10 to 12% of those in their 80s. Electrical storm. Atrial fibrillation occurs when irregular electrical activity in the atria causes the heart's upper two chambers to beat irregularly and fast. The muscles in the atrial walls subsequently quiver or vibrate as they race at 300 to 400 beats a minute. The main risk of quivering atria is that blood flow is therefore sluggish, potentially allowing for the formation of clots. Despite the lack of effective contraction of the atria, the heart's lower chambers, the ventricles, can often still pump blood to the rest of the body fairly effectively. Between the atria and the ventricles is an electrical conduit, AV node, that acts as a checkpoint. The AV node stops many of the atria's excess electrical signals from reaching the ventricles. The ventricles may be faster than normal, but not as fast as the atria. A typical resting heart rate is between 60 and 100 beats per minute. People with atrial fibrillation sometimes develop an irregular heart rate in the range of 100 to 175 beats a minute. This faster overall heart rate can cause the heart to be overworked and stressed, leading to heart failure or worsening of any previously existing heart failure. When atrial fibrillation causes symptoms, they may include lightheadedness, an irregular or racing heartbeat, palpitations, weakness or fatigue, shortness of breath, chest discomfort, or confusion. Some people have periodic episodes of atrial fibrillation that cease on their own. Others have persistent fibrillation that can't be restored to a normal rhythm. Research indicates that the risk of a stroke remains elevated with all types of atrial fibrillation. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And have a healthy day.